Canada's military role in Afghanistan is an issue of increasing debate across the country, with a recent parliamentary vote that took place on Wednesday, May 17th, which extended Canada's military troop presence in the country for 2 years, with the vote slimly passing with 149 votes for and 145 votes against Canada's continued troop presence in Afghanistan. Recent polls suggest that upwards of 60 to 70% of Canadians across the country do not support Canada's current military role in Afghanistan. In February 2006, Canada established a military headquarters in Kandahar, Afghanistan, establishing the Canadian military's major role in the country under the military umbrella of NATO, described by the Canadian Department of National Defense as the TFA, or Task Force Afghanistan. Approximately 2,300 Canadian Forces personnel are currently deployed in the country, the majority in the southern region surrounding Kandahar. On May 25th, Canadian press quoted the current Canadian Defence Minister, Gordon O'Connor, saying that, quote, "The Canadian government's exit strategy from the war-torn country involves staying put until 2009, and at that time, reviewing its options." In the face of Canada's increasing military role in the country, social justice activists across Canada are organizing to oppose the country's troop presence in Afghanistan through demonstrations, awareness raising, direct actions, and public education. Larger numbers of people living in Canada are organizing to oppose the country's military role in Afghanistan. In April 2006, CKUT Radio's Community News Collective in Montreal organized a series of events featuring LA-based activist Sonali Kolhatkar of KPFK Pacifica Radio and the Afghan Women's Mission concerning the relationship between media and war within the context of Canada's increasing military role in Afghanistan. We will now hear Sonali Kolhatkar's presentation, given at La Sala Rosa in Montreal on Sunday, April 9th. This presentation was recorded and edited by Stefan Christoph, for broadcast on CKUT Radio in Montreal, and podcast through the National Film Board of Canada's online media project, Citizen Shift.
Thank you so much for coming tonight to a fantastic event. I'm so pleased to see so many of you here. My expertise is primarily in the United States policy in Afghanistan. I'm an American, and I have been studying U.S. policy in Afghanistan for many years now, since before 9/11, since before the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. And I've been doing solidarity work with a group of Afghan women that I'll be talking to you about today. What I'm going to do is try to address the situation of Canada and Afghanistan compared to what the U.S. has been doing, and also share with you what ordinary Afghan people want from Afghanistan, because those are the silenced voices. Those are the voices that we rarely hear in our media. I was in Afghanistan last year in February of 2005 researching for a book that I'm working on, looking at U.S. policy. Now, as I mentioned, I'm an expert of some sort in U.S. policy in Afghanistan. My expertise is looking at what the U.S. government has been doing there. But since Canadian troops are now increasing and NATO is going to be taking over from the U.S. in Afghanistan, of course, I'll be talking about that. But generally, Canada and NATO are going to be following the same trend. They're going to be following the tactic. There's nothing that NATO and Canada are doing in Afghanistan that the U.S. hasn't already been doing. And so what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan is a good model for us to look at if we want to know what's in store for Canadian troops. Currently, there are about 2,200 Canadian troops in Afghanistan, and that number has been increasing. And they're serving with the United States in southern Afghanistan. They're under the umbrella of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And basically, just to give you a little bit of history, after 2001, when the United States toppled the Taliban government, the United States began fighting a so-called war on terrorism to get rid of the Taliban, to get rid of Al-Qaeda. And the United Nations had a peacekeeping force, or at least it was supposed to be a peacekeeping force, called ISAF, the International Security Assistance Forces, which was supposed to do the work of keeping the peace in Afghanistan after the Taliban fell. ISAF was restricted to Kabul, however, by the United States. The United States insisted that the peacekeepers could not be in the rest of the country because it would somehow interfere with their hunt for Al-Qaeda and Taliban. And there was a political and military vacuum in Afghanistan after the Taliban left that could have been filled, instead of by the warlords and drug lords that are there now, they could have been filled temporarily, perhaps, by some sort of peacekeeping force. Given all the problems of peacekeeping forces, one can at least hope optimistically that that could have happened. But the U.S. insisted there be no peacekeepers in the rest of the country, and instead the United States followed a policy of hunting down and killing Al-Qaeda and Taliban and so-called insurgents in the rest of the countryside. And of course, Canada is going to be continuing in this legacy. There is nothing, and I think Canadians have to be very clear, there is nothing that Canadian troops will be doing in Afghanistan that is not in line with U.S. policy. Let's be really clear, the U.S. is in charge. The U.S. will dictate policy, and Canada will follow, just as the U.K. has been following, just as the rest of the NATO countries have been following. Another stated goal in Afghanistan, and this is a stated goal by the Canadian military, is that we're there to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. We're there to somehow endear them to us by killing Afghans. We're there to make them think of us as benign, benevolent friends who are there to help them rebuild their country. And that's an extremely short-sighted approach. How do you make friends with people while you're busy killing them? And one of the tactics that NATO and Canada have been conducting in Afghanistan is something that the United States pioneered. It's an integration of military and humanitarian work, which is that instead of protecting aid workers, the military is actually doing the aid work, which is a very strange concept. It's what the United States pioneered in the form of so-called provincial reconstruction teams, or PRTs, where 5 to 50 members of the U.S. military, and now, of course, NATO and Canada, would go into a remote province or go into a city in Afghanistan and build a well or build a school for much more money than it would cost an aid organization. And they would basically tell the Afghan people, we're your friend, we're here to help. And aid workers stood back and said, wait a minute, why are you building a well in school? Why aren't you protecting us while we are building wells in schools? What it did was it made aid workers into targets. And the Al-Qaeda and Taliban and so-called insurgent forces, and basically anybody who wasn't very happy about the presence of military, were targeting aid workers because they were then associated with the military presence. Doctors Without Borders, an organization that had been in Afghanistan for 24 years, through the worst of the worst times, left a couple of years ago. But five of their aid workers were killed, and they denounced this policy of military and humanitarian integration, which Canada is continuing on, NATO is continuing on, the concept of provincial reconstruction teams. And so this is another attempt. So on the one hand, the Canadian military is there to kill, and on the other hand, the Canadian military is there to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. How can it do both simultaneously? We have to ask ourselves that question. So the killing part of the Canadian military's tactics comes under the heading of Operation Peacemaker. This is something that the Canadian military launched in March, and I want to quote, it's to, quote, gather intelligence, disrupt Taliban activities, and try to win alliances among village leaders. Operation Peacemaker is not the same as Operation Peacekeeper, because making peace in Afghanistan, according to the Canadian military, is equivalent to waging war in Afghanistan. I think it's really important for us to ask the question of what are the Afghan people saying, right? Because we hear the generals, we hear the media, we hear the government officials, we hear experts like me or commentators or book writers, but what are ordinary Afghan people saying? I want to quote for you from a group that I work with very closely, which is RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. Their website is rawa.org, and all of their statements are listed there. Well, Rawa said, we have time and again reiterated that any effort by the United Nations or any country or international entity to bring peace to Afghanistan and an end to the Afghan conundrum, which does not provide for the disarming of the jihadi and Taliban criminal bands, would be worthless and inexorably doomed in failure from the very outset. So they have said disarmament. This was part of a statement that Rawa put out December 10th, 2000. Almost a year before the attacks of September 11th. They were very clear on what they thought was necessary. Another statement that Rawa made 3 days after the attacks of 9/11, they said, now that the Taliban and Osama are the prime suspects by the U.S. officials after the criminal attacks, will the U.S. subject Afghanistan to a military attack similar to the one in 1998? Clinton had sent a bunch of missiles to Afghanistan in 98 and killed thousands of innocent Afghans for the crimes committed by the Taliban and Osama. Does the U.S. think that through such attacks, with thousands of deprived and poor and innocent people of Afghanistan as its victims, will it be able to wipe out the root cause of terrorism, or will it spread terrorism to an even larger scale? From our point of view, a vast and indiscriminate military attack on a country that has been facing permanent disaster for more than 2 decades will not be a matter of pride. We don't think that such an attack would be the expression or the will of the American people. And in this case, we don't think it might be the will of the Canadian people as well. This was a statement put out by Rawa 3 days after the September 11th attacks. They had the foresight to imagine the U.S. attack that was coming and the foresight to warn the United States of what not to do.
You are listening to a presentation by Sonali Kolhatkar on the relationship between media and war in the context of Canada's growing role in Afghanistan, given in Montreal, Canada, in April 2006, at an event organized by CKUT Radio's Community News Collective.
Then on November 13th, 2001, after the fall of the Taliban, Rawa put out a statement saying, the people of Afghanistan do not accept the domination of the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance was that force in Afghanistan that was opposed to the Taliban, but they were the very same men that the United States had empowered in the 1980s in the jihad against the Soviets. They were the very same men who had the blood of the Afghan people on their hands, who were the criminals who the Afghan people were so tired of that they actually welcomed the Taliban initially, because the Taliban promised an end to the chaos and the crime and the violence and the rape by these men. And so Rawa said, do not bring these men back into power. They said, the world should understand that the Northern Alliance is composed of some bands who showed their real criminal and inhuman nature when they were ruling Afghanistan from 1992 to 1996, when the world's eyes turned away from Afghanistan. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda will be eliminated, but the existence of the Northern Alliance as a military force would shatter the joyful dream of the majority for an Afghanistan free from the odious chains of the barbaric Taliban. The Northern Alliance will horribly intensify the ethnic and religious conflicts and will never refrain to fan the fire of another brutal and endless civil war in order to remain in power. And that was part of Arawa's statement put out in November 13th of 2001. So this is what the Afghan people have been saying, and this was a sentiment that was widespread throughout Afghanistan when I visited there last year. A woman who ran for office in Afghanistan last year in the parliamentary elections, 27-year-old Malalai Joya, she is a hero in Afghanistan. I met her last year when I was there, did an hour-long interview with her, and she rose to fame in 2004 because she took the microphone at a constitutional lawyer jirga, the constitutional convention, and she pointed to all the men who were seated in the front rows, all the warlords, and she said, these men are war criminals. It is a mistake to test those who have been tested once before. And the men rushed to her and they said, you are a communist, you're a prostitute, you're an infidel. In Afghanistan, communist is a dirty word because of the Soviet invasion. They just insulted her in the most horrific way possible. And her life was in absolute danger. Meanwhile, the rest of Afghanistan completely rose up in support of her. People traveled thousands of miles to meet her and to greet her and to let her know that they supported her, because she had broken a wall of silence. She had broken through the fear that exists in Afghanistan, and she had spoken the truth, the simple truth about what was happening there. She speaks for millions of Afghan people, and she ran for parliament last year. She won the second largest number of votes in her province. And Malalai Joya is a national heroine in Afghanistan. She ran for parliament, and she every time she spoke out, on the very first day of the parliament when she spoke out against the warlords in Afghanistan, and they said, we're going to kill you. She has survived 4 assassination attempts and gets routine death threats, but she is saying what the majority of the Afghan people want, which is we don't want the Taliban, we don't want Al-Qaeda, but we don't want the Northern Alliance either. And we don't want Western imperialism either. But we may tolerate the presence of Western forces temporarily until these armed men are out of power. And I want to talk about that in more detail later on. What was the media doing when these people were speaking out? Did you hear Rawa's statements? Did you hear the amazing foresight that Rawa had? Did you hear their predictions, which came true in the end? Did you hear about Malalai Joya? Maybe some of you did because there was a little media coverage. You heard much more about Abdul Rahman, this Christian convert in Afghanistan who attracted so much media attention because he was going to be put to death for converting to Christianity, because Americans, this Christian nation of America, decided that it was absolutely unacceptable to have a country that they supposedly liberated, have one person converting to Christianity be put to death. The U.S. couldn't tolerate that. There was tons of media attention. Where was the media attention on the women of Afghanistan who were predicting the horrific situation that Afghanistan is in today? And the media has played a big role. The subtitle of the book that I'm working on includes The Propaganda of Silence. And by the propaganda of silence, I mean the role that the U.S. and world media has played in helping the governments of the West do their job effectively. When there needs to be media attention, the media will turn to Afghanistan and showcase it. Look, women are suffering under the Taliban. Look, the U.S. has now liberated women. And when the women are suffering, the media will turn away from Afghanistan. And I looked at the correlation between media coverage and U.S. actions and what was happening in Afghanistan. A lot of media coverage during the Soviet invasion, a lot of media coverage when the Soviets pulled out, almost no media coverage during the years 1992 to 1996, when the worst of the crimes were being committed by men who would eventually become known as the Northern Alliance. And then a little bit more media coverage when the Taliban came to power, lots of media coverage after September 11th. And then after the Taliban was defeated, slowly the media coverage has gone down again. Does that mean that there are no newsworthy events happening in Afghanistan? No. And so the media plays a huge role. And it's so important for media outlets like CKUT and other community media to shine the light on what's happening in Afghanistan, because we can only rely on them. We can only turn to alternative media and community media to explain to us the truth of what is really happening in countries like Afghanistan. I want to talk a little bit about why Canada is in Afghanistan. What's the real reason? You know, why is the Canadian military so gung-ho to take their killing machine to Afghanistan? One major reason is NATO, right? Canada's working through the NATO umbrella. After the Cold War ended, there was very little reason for NATO to continue to exist. What was the reason, you know? The very first exercise that NATO did in the post-Cold War era was the 1999 NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. But Afghanistan was the first time that NATO has ever had any operations outside of its member countries, outside of Europe and the Americas. And this is a test case for NATO. And they openly talked about it. If you look at the speeches of NATO generals, they need a reason for NATO to continue to exist. And Afghanistan is a very good reason. We will be junior partner in the U.S.'s war on terror is effectively what NATO is saying. And Afghanistan provides a reason for NATO to exist. If the populations of NATO member countries tolerated it, NATO would probably be in Iraq. But I think the reason why the Canadian military and other NATO countries can be in Afghanistan is because their populations tolerate it. And the fact that Canadians are questioning this is something I don't think they anticipated. So it is my, you know, congratulations to you, the people of Canada, for having 60% of you at the very least questioning why the Canadian troops should be in Afghanistan, because I don't think they anticipated this reaction. Another major reason why Canada is in Afghanistan is money, corporateering, business. And if you look at how the U.S. and the Bush administration has been benefiting from Iraq, it's an interesting model of how Canada is benefiting from Afghanistan. For example, your former Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, is advisor to Bennett Jones, which is a Calgary-based energy firm, and he was invited to speak with Turkmenistan's Prime Minister, Saparmurat Niyazov. This man, Niyazov, is an absolute megalomaniac. The European Union put out a statement in 2003 calling Turkmenistan one of the most totalitarian regimes in the world today. That's who Canadian corporations are happy to do business with. And Jean Chrétien was also an advisor to Petro-Kazakhstan, which is an energy firm that has major interest in the Kazakhstan and Caspian region oil. So essentially, Canadian firms are going to be benefiting from Caspian oil. I'm not sure whether that is what's motivating Canadian troops to be there, but it is an issue that you should know about, that you should be aware of, and that should be raised in this national dialogue about why Canada is in Afghanistan. Are corporate profits really motivating Canadian troops to be present in Afghanistan for the long haul, for the short term? That's an important question. Basically, Canada is going to be a junior partner in this so-called war on terror with the US, with Canada, with the UK. We should be very clear that the Canadian military are just as vicious as the American military are, and they're eager to prove that. So I know that there are probably a lot of activist groups that don't want the blood of the Afghan people on their hands, and so the knee-jerk reaction is, pull out. We want our troops out of there. Get them out now so that we don't have to have that guilt on our hands. Well, there are many forces at work in Afghanistan today. There are the twin forces of religious fundamentalism and Western imperialism. The religious fundamentalist forces come in the shape of Al-Qaeda and Taliban and the so-called insurgency, and in the Northern Alliance, who happen to be our supposed friends. And of course, the Western imperial forces are the US, NATO, etc., with Canada involved. If you just take out the force of Western imperialism, just take it out in one fell swoop, sure, you can walk away thinking that your hands are clean. You've washed your hands off of the blood of the Afghan people. But the Afghan people will be prey to the forces that we have helped set in motion. The damage is done. It's too late to talk about leaving. We have already done the damage. We have already put into motion the forces of religious fundamentalism. The United States has the most responsibility, but Canada, too, is responsible. The vast majority of the Afghan people want disarmament. Survey after survey has shown they want disarmament, and it makes sense. We gave them the weapons. We should take those weapons back. We have no right to just walk away and say, let them deal with the weapons. Let the Afghan people be subject to the weapons, at the mercy of the warlords. We need to fund the disarmament program that exists. There is already a UN program on disarmament in Afghanistan. It's poorly funded. It needs to be fully funded. There needs to be a comprehensive disarmament. Then you can talk about pulling out, because then you have disarmed the warlords. You have taken away the force of Islamic fundamentalism that you helped create in the first place. And then you can talk about taking out the forces of Western imperialism. But that's not it either. It's not just that. The Afghan people have suffered from 2.5 decades of brutal war, and the majority of them identify as victims of war crimes. They want justice. They want a truth and reconciliation commission, you know, like we saw in South Africa. They want some sort of war crimes tribunal. And I'm not talking about the charade that we saw in the former Yugoslavia or Saddam's trial. That's a Western imperialist game. I'm talking about a tribunal that is by and for the people of Afghanistan, with perhaps just funding from the West. And then finally, reparations. We owe the Afghan people reparations for every dollar that was spent on destroying that country. We need to throw in a dollar to rebuild that country in efforts that are led by Afghan people and conducted by Afghan people. These actions, if they were to take place, we'll end the war, we'll end foreign imperialism, we'll end religious fundamentalism. Reparations can help pay for farmers who are involved in the drug trade because they have no other option. The justice tribunals can help heal the wounds of the Afghan people who are so tired of war. They're such a broken people. When I was there last year, it was heartbreaking. They said, the U.S. has turned us into beggars. We will tolerate foreign presence because we have never done so in our history. Afghanistan kicked out the Brits. They kicked out the Soviets. They have never tolerated a foreign presence in their country. Today, they are tolerating it to an extent that they can withstand because they feel that they have no other choice. It's a cynical ploy. And one member of RAWA told me that the U.S. and the West presence in Afghanistan is like a bitter medicine. It's a medicine that we don't want to take, but we feel we may have to take. And then she thought about it, and she said, unfortunately, the medicine has even caused the sickness in this case. And who knows, maybe at some point we'll get tired of taking this medicine. This is an idealistic vision, but I think we should and could pressure our governments to put this vision into action. What do we do in the meantime when our idealistic visions are not being met, but we are at least pushing for them? We can call for solidarity with the people of Afghanistan, with the women of Afghanistan who are doing the hard work of resisting, who are doing the hard work of rebuilding their country, who are resisting both religious fundamentalism and Western imperialism and saying, we don't want a part of either of them, and there are forces like this on the ground. And Rawa is one of them. This is a group that has been around since 1977. They have been doing political work, which is documenting human rights abuses, putting out a publication, a political publication, four times a year, organizing public demonstrations. Imagine thousands of Afghan women with fists in the air and signs marching to the UN building. They do this several times a year, and we fund their demonstrations. They also have humanitarian projects like education, healthcare, orphanages, literacy projects, prostitute rehabilitation programs, income-generating projects. Education is so important for Rawa because they feel that one of the only ways in which their country can move forward. This is a broken country, a country where maternal mortality is among the highest in the world, where infant mortality is the highest in the world, and that hasn't changed since the fall of the Taliban, where the average lifespan of a woman is 46 years old, where the literacy rate among Afghan women is between 4 and 10%. This is a country that has been used, abused, and abandoned by the international community, and we cannot let that happen. As activists in good conscience, we have to support movements that are already existing, indigenous movements that are taking the lead. All they need is financial solidarity and moral solidarity. They don't need our advice, but they need our support. And we can support women like the members of Rawa. We can support these grassroots organizations that are doing the hard work of rebuilding their country. We can support women like Malalai Joya, who lives in danger every day. Recently, Hamid Karzai took away the security guards that were protecting her. She doesn't expect to live out the year. What does democracy mean if a woman can't speak out and speak truth? I want to end by quoting for you from Rawa's latest statement. They celebrate International Women's Day every year on March 8th, and they just recently celebrated this important day. The title of the statement is "Let's Rise United and Resolute for Liberation and Against Fundamentalism." They said, "Another 8th of March has arrived, but still the Afghan women are hostage to the fundamentalist clause. Murder, robbery, kidnapping, and rape of women and children has become routine. There's a high rate of women committing suicide and an ever-expanding cultivation and trafficking of narcotics, all the while billions of dollars of foreign aid and public resources are squandered away, and unemployment and homelessness is on the rise." But then they end saying, "We are not alone in our difficult and tumultuous struggle against the Northern Alliance and Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The women of Iran, Kurdistan, Palestine, Turkey, Latin America, and other countries are in combat for democracy and against the plague of fundamentalism and war. We sympathize with them, and we must assist the movement of women in the rest of the world by intensifying our decisive struggle against fundamentalism and their supporters in the region. Long live the solidarity between the resilient women of Afghanistan and other countries." And that's the statement that Rawa just put out on March 8th. How many of you have heard of Rawa? How many of you have heard of this amazing women's rights organization that is fighting against all odds? You haven't heard about them because the media doesn't cover them, and when media coverage drops, our donations plummet. They've been forced to close down schools and orphanages, and they are so afraid that the world will abandon them once more. Well, one thing that you Canadians can do while you are upset about, and rightfully so, of the presence of your troops in Afghanistan is to support the indigenous movements of resistance and women's liberation in Afghanistan. They don't need to know how to liberate themselves. They are very capable and aware of liberating themselves. They need for us to get our governments off their backs. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a presentation by Sonali Kolhatkar of KPFK Pacifica Radio and Afghan Women's Mission concerning the relationship between media and war within the context of Canada's increasing military role within Afghanistan. This presentation was given in Montreal at an event organized by CKUT Radio's Community News Collective in April 2006. For more information on the Afghan Women's Mission, visit their website at www.afghanwomensmission.org. That's www.afghanwomensmission.org. This presentation was recorded and edited by Stefan Christoph for broadcast on CKUT Radio in Montreal and podcast through the National Film Board of Canada's online media project, Citizen Shift.